This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture. I'm PJ Thumb, and I'm a historian from the University of Oxford. This is the history of Singapore. Episode 9. To the left, to the left, everything you own in a box to the left. To the left, to the left. The quote-unquote left is a broad term that we apply to a wide range of anti-colonial movements that originated in Malaya in the first third of the 20th century, who would go on to have a major influence on the decolonization movements of both Singapore and the Federation after the war. These are the forces which would define our history. But despite their massive importance, we know relatively little about them. Their origins defy easy explanation. The left is a broad political spectrum with a wide range of beliefs and ideologies. It grows out of several different sources, including local grievances, British labour activism, Chinese and Indonesian revolution, and Malay society. It encompassed a wide variety of tactics, from the soft, gradual reformist socialism of the Fabian Society to the Malay nationalism of the Kesatuan Melayu Muda, or KMM, to the revolutionary communist ideals of the Malayan Communist Party, MCP, to the anarchists who sowed terror through violence and murder. It's a wide range of organizations that cover a wide range of beliefs and tactics that I mentioned. It's more than just the MCP or KMM. Indeed, we can argue that there is more than one MCP, since the party keeps getting broken up by colonial repression, only for new people to take up the mantle. There's no one clear movement, no one clear ideology, no one clear leader. People belong to multiple organizations, or none at all, held conflicting beliefs, or indeed were only united by a common sense of anti-colonialism. Remember, the world in between the wars is a very chaotic time. Empires that have lasted for centuries are falling apart. The very assumptions that hold our societies together have come under attack, or even been destroyed. And people are groping, searching for answers, grasping at anything which can solve the existential questions that they are faced with. To the left, to the left. So to learn about the left, you must first unlearn. To the left, to the left. So what I'm going to do this week is to first sketch out some broad patterns, some basic principles by which we can categorize the left, and then talk about some examples of the left in the 1920s. When I say the left, of course, I am applying a broad label very loosely. If you were reading this, you would see the word left encased by quotation marks. But it's going to be hugely disruptive if I say quote-unquote left all the time. So this is what I'll do. Whenever I mean to say quote-unquote left, I will include a dramatic pause and reading of the word so that you know that it's in quotes, like this. The left. Okay, let's begin. In the past few weeks, we have discussed a series of critical challenges to colonial and imperial regimes in the period after the First World War, including, of course, in Singapore. War, nationalism, self-determination, and global economic crisis produced crises of faith, leading people to re-evaluate their identities, to re-evaluate what it meant to be Muslim or Chinese or Malay or Malayan, or what it meant to be a worker or a citizen or a subject or a human being. Colonial capitalism produced an oppressed, exploited working class in colonies like Singapore, while the reconfiguration of economic relationships led to the rise of the working class as a political force. So imagine you are a person living in the backdrop of global turmoil and personal hardship caused by capitalist exploitation, by colonial repression and discrimination. in the backdrop of nationalist conflict and global economic crisis. What do you do? What is your answer? And the answers were the entire spectrum of ideologies that we call collectively
the left.
We can start by thinking of the left as a response to all these challenges and changes. And hence, there are a number of commonalities to the huge variety of ideologies that comprise
the left.
First,
the left
arise out of exclusion from the colonial elite, or even oppression by the colonial elite, and hence they are anti-establishment. And this is perhaps the most unifying factor of
the left.
Opposition to, and even a desire to, overthrow the oppressive, conservative establishment. And in a colonial society, the elite are the colonial power, so by extension, inevitably,
the left
are anti-colonial. It is colonialism, after all, which created the situation they find themselves in. But the establishment can also include the local elites who align themselves with the colonial powers. The Malay rulers and aristocracy, the economic elites like the Chinese, Arab and Indian businessmen, and so on. But it's important to note that the leaders of
the left
are also often elites in their own way. They're often very highly educated people who are intelligent and ambitious, people who feel that they should have a say in the future of the country or the nation, but who have been excluded from power because of their social class or status or language or religion or skin color. In a meritocracy, they would be the elite. But in a colonial and or traditional conservative society, they are excluded because of their background. And so often all they want is to be given a fair chance. But in order to get a fair chance, they have to break down a society which unfairly discriminates against them by building anti-establishment movements, by mobilizing other people who are also unfairly excluded or discriminated against. And then, hopefully, building a new meritocratic society. With the Chinese
left,
the broad masses of the community were workers who suffered from economic oppression and exclusion. As I mentioned in a previous episode, the Kuomintang's left wing organized modern labor organizations to obtain support and funding for its activities in China, including the Nanyang General Labor Union, or GLU, in 1926. After the Kuomintang split in 1927, left-wing Chinese in Malaya formed the Nanyang Communist Party. Under orders from the Comintern, the Communist International, to pursue a strict line of proletarian revolution, it could not ally with liberal or nationalist elements and thus struggled to win support from all but the poorest Chinese, chiefly the Hainanese. It then reorganized as the Malayan Communist Party in 1930, taking control of the Nanyang GLU and renaming it the Malayan GLU. However, due to ruthless police attacks, a lack of leadership and financial difficulties, it was never able to exercise significant influence. The MCP found it difficult to motivate workers in the midst of an economic depression when workers were afraid of losing their jobs. In response to the recession, immigration quotas were imposed and many workers repatriated, a move designed as much to deal with political dissidents as unemployment. And this was resented by businesses who lost a cheap source of labour. However, for workers who survived, it was a blessing in disguise because it created a settled labour pool. And when the economy picked up, this enhanced their negotiating position as employers could no longer easily import replacement workers. By the mid-1930s, the economy was reviving, but wages and working conditions failed to rise with profits. Seeking a fair deal, workers turned to trade unions, who began to have greater success. In 1936, more than 10,000 workers in Singapore and Selangor and elsewhere struck. Business owners appealed to the government for action, but its investigations found that this was in response to a failure of employers to pay a proper wage and was not communist instigated. This outcome, however, was an exception. The British were unable to comprehend the cultural and political and intellectual changes sweeping the labour movement. Instead, it dealt with their manifestations on a regulatory basis using arrests and banishments. They passed a series of increasingly restrictive legislation, created the special branch to deal specifically with political subversion, and shut down several newspapers. Special branch in general was overzealous in branding genuine grievances as subversion, and employers often took advantage. When the MCP attempted to exploit worker unhappiness by planning 50 strikes between September 1936 and April 1937, its leaders were immediately arrested and banished, and the MCP was virtually destroyed. Because of the destruction of its leadership, the Vietnamese Loi Tech rose to become head of the MCP by 1938. He was a double agent for the British, although when he started working for the British is not clear. Indeed, some historians argue that the arrests and destruction of the MCP in 1935 were facilitated by Loi Tech with the aim of inserting the British agent as the head of the party. We don't know if it's true, but what we do know is that for a decade and throughout the war, the MCP was led by a man who worked for the British and later the Japanese. And it is, in retrospect, amazing that a party which was led by a British double agent could rise to become such an existential threat to the British. And it shows the depth of popular feeling, the depth of popular will behind the MCP. When we return, we will talk about the Malay left in Malaya, who are very different from the Chinese left. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture, and I'm PJ Thum. If you've just joined us, on this week's episode of The History of Singapore. So the left, to the left, everything you own in a box to the left. To the left, to the left. We are talking about the Malayan left. So we've been talking about the left who drew influence from revolutions in China and Indonesia and who were chiefly mobilized through labor activism. But they weren't the only left. There is an interesting phenomenon going on here that might seem a little bit counterintuitive. The left in Singapore that we think about, the reformist or radical socialists, come out of the British and Chinese and Indonesian leftist movements. The Malayan Communist Party, for example, is highly influenced by Indonesian and Chinese communism. But they are generally Chinese. The Malay left, on the other hand, arise from different and almost completely local indigenous roots. Their early leaders, like Ibrahim Yaakob or Ishak Mohammed, were highly educated, highly motivated men, educated at places like Sultan Idris Teachers Training College, but who came from outside the traditional Malay elite. Despite their talents, intelligence, and ambition, they could not advance in a traditional hierarchical society. In order to do so, they would have to overturn the traditional structure of Malay society, break the power of the Malay aristocracy, end the distinction between the rulers and their subjects. And this leads to my second point about the left as a whole, that the left sought to reconceptualize society. They wanted to change the assumptions, the structures, and the relationships which govern society. Because these assumptions and structures and relationships led to oppression and exploitation and inequality and discrimination. It is no good one or two people defying the odds to join the elite. You need to break the idea that a certain person or group of people could be raised above others because of who their parents were, or what the colour of their skin was, or what language they spoke, or what faith they pursued. And in the place of the old order, what would they replace the old order with? One way, of course, in which society can be reconfigured is through the ideals of socialism. Remember, this is the 1920s, long before the excesses of socialism. Cast away all your preconceived notions of socialism and put yourself in the frame of mind of someone in the midst of the Great Depression. This is a world which has just undergone the excess of capitalism, which has caused death and destruction and hardship on a mass scale. Colonialism, world war, economic depression. People want to move past that. They want to build a society, a world without war, a better world. And so the emergent ideas of socialism seek to change the institutions and incentive structures around us. By changing our economic relationships to each other, allowing us to work to be equal, instead of exploiting and enslaving each other, we can build a better future together. This appealing ideology would capture the imagination of many people who aspired to build a better world out of the ashes of the old. And is very much what the Chinese left worked towards. On the other hand, the Malay left aspired to a different set of ideals, the ideals of Melayu Raya or Pan-Indonesianism. They sought to transcend the Malay monarchy and aristocracy, which was based on the Malacca Sultanate model, by looking to Melayu Raya. This is a really sophisticated concept which needs some explaining. Melayu Raya is not about unifying Malaya and Indonesia, or even unifying the Malay-speaking territories of Southeast Asia. These state lines are colonial borders, but the movement sought to transcend colonial structures and institutions. Instead, think of the broader cultural entity of Nusantara, or the Malay world. This is not a cohesive or definitively defined area. It's a broad cultural area with vague outlines that encompasses the areas of maritime Southeast Asia with a common linguistic and cultural heritage, which includes everything from the Philippines all the way across to Patani and Aceh. This is a region which predates the colonial period and was divided up by the colonial powers into separate political units which continue to exist today. So Melayu Raya looks both back to the pre-colonial and seeks to transcend the narrow boxes that colonialism has placed us in to articulate a new form, a new modern form of Malay nationalism. One that transcends the most state-based forms of nationalism towards a more cultural form of nationalism. One that not only challenges the Malay sultans and aristocracy's definitions of Malayness, but also acknowledges that their Malacca sultanate-based model of Malay governance is but one of many traditions of Malayness that have existed across the archipelago. There's also Sriwijaya and Majapahit and the sultanates of Brunei and Aceh and Mataram and Alam Minangkabau, among others. Melayu Raya was all of these and none of these. It was the past and the future. It was an inclusive, not exclusive identity. It was a response to the upheavals of the world of the 1920s and 30s by looking beyond political lines, by looking beyond colonial structures to forge a new nationalism. It was with this in mind that Ibrahim Yaakob wrote on the 1st of December 1932 in Majlis.
It is obvious that the Peninsular Malays have not yet understood the idea of nation and nationalism. Oh, my Malay people, the entire peninsula and the Indonesian archipelago is the possession of our common ancestors, the Malays. The names Minangkabau, Bugis, Jawa, Brunei, Aceh, Lampung, Palembang, Rawa, Kampur, Kelantan, Perak, they are not the names of nations, but of states. Our real ethnic identity is Malay. The entire Indonesia possess a custom similar to that of the Peninsular Malays. What is it then that sets us apart? It is simply the fate of our unity under the yokes of two colonial powers, that is the Dutch in the Indonesia archipelago and the British in the peninsula. But this should not alter the unity of our people, a unity that will not give way under the impact of the rain, nor crack under the impact of the sun.
That was Ibrahim Yaakob. And this then hints at the third of the characteristics which defined the left in Malaya, which is the international influence. While of course the movements were rooted or grounded in local circumstance, they drew upon regional and global ideologies of nationalism and self-determination. But more than that, the left is inherently internationalist because it seeks to transcend things which divide us, like artificial state boundaries, and focuses on common issues which unite us, like human rights and justice. The left recognizes that the problems and injustices that we face transcend national borders and are impossible to solve by one country alone or in one country alone. It wants to bring working people together wherever they are, because just as colonial powers did not stop at their own borders but globalized their oppression, so likewise, multinational corporations today globalize, exporting labor exploitation around the world, and therefore, labor, working people too have to globalize if we are to be an effective counterweight to the concentration of wealth and power in states and corporations. We are all in this together. This internationalism has motivated and underpinned many of the great left-wing movements, including the great inspiration for Singapore's left, Bandung. Afro-Asianism is but one of the many ways in which the exploited have sought to band together to resist the exploiters. The response of conservative and reactionary elements has, of course, been to accuse the left of being anti-patriotic, arguing that by seeking to draw upon internationalism, they are betraying their country, their nation. Which of course brings us back to episode 4 of this podcast. The idea that nationalism is both empowerment but also a tool for oppression. Nations are constructed, imagined communities created only by the power of belief. Internationalism is simply another form of community, another nation. And you may have a listen to episode 4 if you haven't already. The fourth characteristic of the left is that its movements are largely urban. The transformative effect of urbanization and industrialization, access to education, communications and news, proximity to oppression and exploitation, a sufficient number of people to form a critical mass, access to funding and resources, and so on. This is why the left is found chiefly in the urban centers of Malaya, and most prominently in the educational, transportation, communications, and financial hub of the region, Singapore. So, in sum, we can generalize the Malayan left as arising in response to exclusion, oppression, discrimination. It is by definition anti-colonial, anti-establishment, and so it seeks to transform society, to challenge its rules and to introduce new imaginings of nation, state and society. It is international and it is urban. But what is it not? Well, first, it is not non-communal. We remember the left as a multi-ethnic movement, but we remember that this is only true much later in the 1950s, and even then, only partially so. In the 1920s, they remained very much constructed on communal lines. Indeed, the MCP was not just Chinese, it was heavily Hainanese. In this period, divisions within the ethnicities remain important. Asking if a Hainanese is really Chinese remains a valid question at this point. Just like asking if a Malay or a South Asian is really a Muslim. Also a valid question. So the reasons why the MCP was so heavily Hainanese are actually very debated. But what is true is that the Hainanese were the poorest of the Chinese and were often looked down upon by the other Chinese. It is thus among the lowest of the low, those who are the most oppressed and have the least to lose, who are the most eager to embrace revolution. The MCP was also heavily influenced, as I mentioned, by Indonesian communism. But as we mentioned in the episode on Islamic modernism, Indonesian revolutionaries had a hard time cultivating revolution among the Malays, and so also worked with the Chinese. It was the Malay left who had more influence among the Malays, people who appealed to a different sense of nationalism that was grounded more in local history and culture. And so we have two main strands of leftism who find common interests but do not significantly overlap in this period. The second thing is the left is not ideological. While there is a marked affinity to socialism in many of these organizations, socialist ideology is far from being a constant characteristic of these organizations. It is really important that we avoid adopting a narrow understanding of the left, particularly Western or modern notions of the left, and transplanting them to 1920s Malaya. The fact is that most of the organizations that we call the left in Malaya were to the right of the British Labour Party, for example. We don't generally have calls for nationalization of industry or redistribution of wealth or socialization of healthcare or education or many of the other key policies of the British Labour Party. The left, as applies to Malaya, is more tolerant of socialist ideas and influences, but it is anti-colonialism, an opposition to the discrimination of colonial society, which unites the left, not ideology. Indeed, we can say the history of Malaya in the 20th century is the history of class struggle, but not just in the economic sense, in the way Marx talked about it, but in all the various manifestations of power, ideological, military, political, and economic. It is a battle between the elite class, the exploiters and oppressors of colonial society, those who control the ideological and military and political and economic power, and those traditionally exploited by the elite class or subject to the elite class. This battle shapes and defines Malaya's decolonization. This is the tradition which gives birth to the left. Finally, the left is not inherently violent. All serious left-wing movements in Malaya sought initially to achieve their aims through peaceful constitutional measures. This, of course, does not include the extremist and fringe elements of the left, like the anarchists. Some men just want to watch the world burn. But the serious parties, including the KMM and the MCP, they all tried constitutional action first, but often they were not given the option of achieving peaceful constitutional progress. Repression and violence by the colonial government suppressed any possibility of peaceful constitutional progress, forcing them to seek more radical means to achieve their ends. And from the early 1930s, colonial repression heavily intensified, suppressing many of these movements, destroying the MCP, locking up the leading members of the KMM, ending left-wing politics. So I want to stress that these left-wing movements represent essential continuities with what happens after World War II. The disruption of the Japanese occupation presents a misleading sense of distance between the events before the war and the events after. But a better way of understanding this period is to think of the 1920s as the birth of left-wing movements in Malaya, the 1930s is a period when the British colonial authorities ruthlessly suppressed and destroyed many of these left-wing movements, and then the early 1940s as a time when the Japanese then in turn ruthlessly dispatched the British, thus giving the previous left-wing movement space to revive and re-establish themselves and grow into the more coherent and organized movements we see after World War II. So, finally, we have arrived at this point where in the last few weeks we have discussed all the forces which shaped Malaya and Malayan nationalism in the first three decades of the 20th century. Next week, we look at how the British responded to these forces of change with violence and suppression. Join us then. As always, if you have any questions, comments or feedback, please email me at thehistoryofsingapore@gmail.com or visit my webpage at thehistoryofsingapore.com. If you'd like to support the show, visit Patreon, patreon.com/pjthumb. See you next week. This has been The History of Singapore, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.